go ahead and get started. Okay, good morning. Today I'd like to talk about two topics, time delay estimation and adaptive differential pulse code modulation. We'll spend most of the time on time delay estimation and a little bit of time on ADPCM, as it's called. And then if there's time left over, I'll talk a little bit more about echo cancellation. I provided some resources. Time delay estimation is used in a number of ways. One of the most common is an application called beamforming, so I gave you a nice link to that. Adaptive differential pulse code modulation was one of the first major compression techniques used in the long-distance telephone network and in other speech compression systems back in the late 1970s. And there's a large body of literature on this kind of a technique, differential coding. I've actually provided a link to differential coding of images, since we haven't talked a lot about image processing in this course. And it'll give you a chance to, if you read that, to see that the techniques in image are basically the same as in one-dimensional signals. It's just now you've got two dimensions to deal with. So let's begin by talking about time delay estimation. So our challenge in time delay estimation is to estimate the time delay between two signals. Applications for this include radar, sonar, geophysics, biomedical, and actually audio. We have a schematic to the right of how this works. We have a signal that's propagating at some direction to our sensors, P1 and P2. There's a few key assumptions we're going to make about this. So the two measurements are made by sensors P1 and P2, and these sensors are separated by a distance we'll call small d. This plane wave is propagating in such a manner that we're going to assume that this wave is essentially going to consist of two things, signal plus noise. We're going to assume that the only difference in the signal between these two sensors is some time delay, which we're going to call capital D. Now, if you know anything about electromagnetic or acoustic wave propagation, the first thing you'll say is, well, the signal is likely to be attenuated at P2 as compared to P1, since those are separated by a distance D, and typically these kinds of waves, the amplitude level falls off at the rate of like 1 over D or 1 over D squared. But what we're going to assume here is that the distance between these two sensors is small with respect to a wavelength for this signal. And thereby, we can sort of assume that the amplitude of the signal does not really change much between these two points, nor does the frequency response of the signal. The distance between these two sensors is relatively small compared to the scale of the signal. Now, that's a pretty good assumption for most signals that we use this kind of technology for, particularly in applications like audio and sonar, where we're dealing with fairly, what you might say, is low-frequency signals, signals that have energy below 8 kilohertz or below 16 kilohertz, on that order. That's fairly leads to wavelengths for the signal, which are pretty long. And the distance between these sensors is fairly short. With a microphone array, let's say in an automobile, you may be talking about distances that are less than a foot. And so that's not such a bad assumption. What's going to be more limiting, actually, is our assumptions about the noise that is received at these two sensors. So a simple model for the received signals is going to be that x1 of t, which corresponds to the first sensor p1, x1 of t is equal to s of t, the signal of interest, plus v1 of t, some noise. x2 of t is going to be equal to the signal s of t delayed by some amount d, and another noise, v2. S of t is the signal which is derived from some distant source and modeled as traveling at a constant speed. V1 and V2 are additive noise terms measured at the receiver, and D is the delay. V1 and V2, for most of our analysis, will be assumed to be zero mean stationary, mutually uncorrelated. We also assume that these measurement noises are uncorrelated with the signal, S of T, and those, of course, are very big assumptions, so let's talk a little bit more about that. So the first thing we might want to think about is, well, how does the noise compare between sensors V1 and V2? And if you look at X1 and X2, you say, well, one way to get rid of the noise would be to simply subtract these two signals and hope that the noise cancels, because if the noise is the same here as it is here, then when I subtract the two, the noise will cancel. But there's a couple problems with that. One is that if I subtract these two, what I get is S of T minus S of T minus D. If in fact the noise is canceled, that was lucky enough to achieve that, I would still be left with S of T minus S minus S of T minus D. Now, what does that do to the frequency response of S of T? If instead of getting S of T, you get S of T minus S of T minus D, how might you compare the spectra of these two signals? What's the frequency response of S of T minus S of T minus D going to look like? If we apply, for example, a Z transform to that, or a Fourier transform, continuous time doesn't really matter. What's going to happen? Time delay is equivalent to what? Z to power minus D, right? Very good. So we're going to have a filter here, which is 1 minus Z to the power minus D, right? Now, what's the frequency response of a filter like that? Is it all pole or all zero? Is it FIR or IIR? H of Z is 1 minus Z to the minus D. Try again. FIR. It's a finite impulse response filter. Finite impulse response filters are composed of zeros or poles. Try again. Zeros, right? In fact, the zeros of a filter, 1 minus Z to the minus D, are equispaced along the Z-axis. So the frequency response of this signal, if you were to just difference these two, the frequency response of that difference is going to be the signal of interest with all sorts of zeros cutting out significant portions of the spectrum. In fact, if you listen to this signal, it will sound very reverberant, because this is essentially an echo. Now, you're used to hearing this kind of data if you've ever listened to, if you've participated in like a teleconference where you have a fairly inexpensive desk-mounted microphone. These microphones pick up not just the signal directly impinging the microphone, but they also pick up reflections off the surfaces, and you can hear that in that reverberation in the signal. You'll also hear that kind of reverberation if you listen to the audio from the lectures, since that open-air mic gets a lot of reflections. So simply differencing these things is going to have some bad effects on the spectrum if we don't take into account this time delay. And that's why, essentially, we need this adaptive beamformer. We need a way of finding the optimal value of this time delay and adjusting the signal for that value. That's what time delay estimation is all about, and that's why we need to do time delay estimation. Now, secondly, what about the noises? Well, The signals of interest, you might say, well, the difference, the signal I receive at P1 is likely to be the same as the signal I receive at B2. Would that be true, though, for the noise? Would that be, to what extent would that be true for the noise, and how would you contrast that to the signal? Well, the noise has much more high-frequency components than the signal, right? And therefore, the chance that this distance would be small with respect to the noise is less. Secondly, the noise is likely to be coming not just from the same direction as the signal, but actually coming from different directions. So the chance that the noise, that the signal, that the noise here and the noise here is the same is actually smaller. And therefore, what we really need is some kind of adaptive filter that does two things. It estimates the time delay, and it tries to remove the effects of the noise. And we want an adaptive filter because, again, we don't want to have to estimate a priori statistics of the noise. We just want a system that we can turn it on, let it train on the data, and do its thing, as we say, without any kind of a priori assumptions. Now, the delay D can be related to the angle of arrival of the signal. We can write an simple expression using geometry and using the speed of propagation that the time delay D can be related to the distance of separation, small d, divided by the c, the propagation velocity, times sine of theta. So finding the time delay is essentially the same as finding the angle theta, or because d and c are known to us. So this is why, one example of why you'll see most of these attempts to localize the source of the signal to be a function of the time delay, because time delay then can be directly related to theta.
How you got the, this morning?
You set that. The spacing of these sensors is one thing that's under your control. You decide how far you want these microphones placed. Now, how you would set that in a real application, you actually look at typically about a quarter wavelength of the signal. You look at the wavelength of the signal, and then you take a quarter. You look at a quarter of that, and then you make sure that spacing is less than a quarter wavelength. And if you don't understand those kinds of details, don't worry about it. But that's the kind of thing that you worry about when you do things like array processing, because you want the distance to be small with respect to the quarter wavelength so that there's not a significant phase shift between these two points. So the estimation of the bearing angle is reduced to estimation of the delay D given these noisy measurements X1 and X2. So we're going to have the problem of removing noise and estimating this time delay, and we're going to do that simultaneously. Now, you'll note that the book doesn't really talk about this, but there's a topic devoted to this called array processing. There's nothing special about simply using two sensors here. You can actually use multiple sensors to localize sounds in two dimensions, three dimensions, and in fact, typically, if you use a plane of sensors here, you can localize in two dimensions. And if you use sometimes, if you want to localize in three dimensions, you'll actually put sensors on three planes. So it's not uncommon in sophisticated conferencing facilities to have sensors on three surfaces that are perpendicular to one another, and that allows you then to localize to a particular point in space. This is actually done in advanced teleconferencing microphones where you're trying to track multiple speakers simultaneously so that you can remove the crosstalk and the echo between them. So if you've ever had a chance to use a fairly high-performance teleconferencing facility, they usually have microphone arrays that track people as they're speaking. And that's actually an interesting application because you have to develop these adaptive filters and run multiples of them so that you can track different speakers in real time. A similar sonar and radar is another excellent example of this. If you watch the Science Channel, you may be familiar with things like these very massive radio telescope arrays that they're building, where they have hundreds or thousands of these sensors spaced in a grid, and they're using these to detect signals very deep in space. You may also be familiar with one of the great applications of this kind of thing in sort of the military was, you may remember in World War II, radar systems used to spin. Right? You're often probably familiar with pictures where you see the radar spinning. Well, guess what? Most of them don't spin anymore. They spin them electronically, which is called electronic beam steering. And what they will do instead of physically spinning the radar is they have a plane of sensors and they phase them electronically so that they actually steer the beam and scan the beam electronically. And one of the reasons that's really neat is because they can also do that for multiple targets. So they can actually track multiple targets from a stationary radar just by running these adaptive filters in real time and tracking targets of interest. And that was a major advance in this kind of technology for the military. And then you can turn that kind of thing around and actually track targets, missiles, and you hear a lot these days about smart weapons and this kind of thing. And they, again, use very similar technology with the way they can track targets and missiles can actually chase targets now and that kind of thing. But another example that I like to point out, which you're all familiar with, you're all essentially born with a very good sound localization system, your ears. Your ears are very, very good at localizing the source of a signal. And another thing your ears do, and coupled with your brain very well, is to track multiple targets. You go into a large room where lots of people are talking, and you effortlessly kind of keep track of all these different conversations going on. You use a process which is very similar to this, but as usual, humans do a lot better job of this, especially in the presence of noise. So these are other examples of this kind of thing. Time delay estimation, it's sort of a very fundamental signal processing problem because it has so many different applications. So let's see how we can apply our that worries me. Yeah, I think that slide should have been in the deck. I'm sorry, let me just take a minute. Yeah, let's just skip that slide. I didn't realize that was in the deck. Okay, so the first way that we deal with this is the situation where we have, when you have additive noise like this, the first thing you think about is, well, one way to get rid of that noise would be to cross-correlate the signals from the two sensors. And if you correlate the signals from the two sensors, you hope that the noise V1 correlated with V2, the expectation of V1 times V2 is zero. So when you do this kind of an operation, you hope that the noise will cancel and you'll be left with the cross-correlation of S of T and S of T minus D. And then if you can estimate the delay, you can actually undo the S of T times S of T minus D. So the time delay can be estimated using correlation techniques. And the way we do that, the way we historically first attempted that, was to simply use a cross-correlation function of x1 and x2, which is just the expectation of x1 of t times x2 of t minus tau. This was actually implemented in analog hardware in real time in early implementations when we did not have signal processing chips that were fast enough to process this data in real time. You could implement this cross-correlation operation in analog hardware, and you would set the time delay of this function, you'd set the time delay as the peak in the correlation of this function. So that what you do is you compute the correlation, you'd scan that function for the maximum value, you'd set that delay to the maximum value, and then you could reconstruct the signal. A more rigorous approach to this is known as the Knapp-Carter generalized correlation method, and that's a simple variant of this where you apply a weighting function, you convolve the cross-correlation function with the weighting function. That weighting function, you can think of that as a filter, but that weighting function allows for you to account for any kind of linear filtering that might be done to enhance the signal. Because if you go back to slide number two, one of the things we need to worry about here is the extent to which this noise changes frequency response from sensor P1 to sensor P2. And the extent to which this noise, as when it's received at these sensors, is actually colored noise, not white noise. That's actually a very significant issue when you build these kinds of arrays, because the signal that you're getting at this sensor is often the reflection of, often contains the reflection of many different components of the signal. So the noise will rarely be simply white noise. It'll always have some kind of frequency shaping to it. So the way we can deal with that, with this technique, is to apply a weighting function. And then you can go through a maximum likelihood analysis. Once you postulate that, then you ask the question, well, how can I do a maximum likelihood estimate of this weighting function and the and the time delay? And we won't go through that derivation today because we haven't really discussed maximum likelihood estimates in great detail. We'll do that later in the course. But you can show that the what's called the magnitude squared coherence function, which we'll define as this gamma 1,2 of omega squared, you can show that this is just equal to the magnitude of the cross-correlation of x1 and x2 squared over the autocorrelation of x1 and the autocorrelation of x2. You can really think about this as nothing more than a statistical correlation. And this is a fairly standard approach to estimating. We can use this function to estimate the delay. And I'll show later, we'll sort of show an example of that. The maximum likelihood weighting function for this task can be shown to be given by the autocorrelation of the signal divided by the autocorrelation of the noise. That quantity divided by 1 plus 2 times the autocorrelation of the signal divided by the autocorrelation of the noise. Now, this assumption actually assumes that the noise at each sensor have the same spectrum, which are this RVV of omega. In the book, they actually talk about a more detailed version of this where you don't have to make this assumption, but I just wanted to cite this to give you an idea of what the solutions, what the maximum likelihood solutions for these problems look like. Now again, why is this kind of a solution useless to us in an adaptive filtering sense? This was the classical solution to this problem, probably developed in the mid-1960s. Why is this not useful to us? And why do we prefer to try to solve these problems using an adaptive filter? We need the autocorrelation function of the signal.
Yes.
We need the autocorrelation function of the noise. And if the noise is, that in itself is a problem, we have to get those offline. And if the noise is non-stationary, then we don't have any ability for this filter really to track. So what we prefer then for this application is a LMS-based time delay estimator. So we can formulate this using our adaptive filter approach. We can take the signal x2 of n, which is s of n minus d times v2 plus v2 of n. We can then take x1 of n, which is s of n plus v1 of n. We can apply x1 of n to a filter we'll call f. The output of that filter will be y of n. Y of n is just going to be the convolution of s of n plus v1 of n and the filter f. We can then difference y of n with x2 of n, and that produces the error signal e of n. And then we can adjust the coefficients of this filter based on the error signal e of n. Now, in this scenario, what do we want the characteristics of this filter to be so that this will work? Well, we're going to take a difference here, right? So what's one of the things this filter has to do if it's going to successfully cancel the noise? Well, what's the difference between these two? If we just difference these, suppose this filter was just an impulse function, then what we're going to get out here is s of n, we're going to have s of n minus d here. If we difference those two, we're going to have s of n minus d. That's not a good thing. That gets back to what we talked about at the beginning of class, that that's going to introduce a distortion into s of n. So what is the first thing this filter is going to have to do? Well, let me see. It's called the LMS time delay estimator.
Time delay.
So the first thing this filter has to do is it has to produce a time delay. Its impulse response better peak at the delay D of the signal. That way, when we subtract these two, we'll actually reinforce the signal. We would expect the filter to actually be minus one times the signal, so that when we subtract these two, we'll reinforce the signal. And then we also hope that this filter will somehow allow these noises to cancel. Now, for that to happen, we need the time delay, because these sensors are, we hope that V1 and V2 are fairly close in statistical properties. But if they aren't, we also hope that this filter will make V1, the delayed version of V1 of n minus d, look more like V2 by basically acting as a coloring filter that shapes the spectrum of V1 so that it resembles V2. So this adaptive filter is going to do two things. It's going to delay the signal, and it's going to try to match the frequency response of V1 of n with V2 of n. And that's what the time delay estimator actually does. The delay D is taken as the maximum value of the filter's impulse response. Now, one of the sort of subtle problems that we encounter with this kind of filter is that the peak of the impulse response may not actually occur at a sample instance. It could occur between two samples. Now, you might not think that that's significant, but depending on the sample frequency and the spacing of the microphone, of the sensors, that the difference between, let's say, half of a sample in terms of time delay can be significant. It also depends somewhat on the propagation speed of the signal. So there are techniques that sort of extend this approach that can actually determine the value of D, the delay, to less than a sample instant. But we won't really talk about that because that's just sort of a beyond the scope of this course. But it is possible to embed in this an interpolation function so that you can estimate these arrival times much more accurately than one sample time. But for simplicity, we're going to assume that the delay is an integer multiple of the number of samples. So we can write an expression for the error signal, E of n, which is the output of this summer. We can write that E of n is equal to x2 of n minus y of n. So E of n here is just x2 of n minus y of n. And x2 of n is just s of n minus d plus v2 of n. Y of n is just the convolution of s of n plus v1 of n convolved with f of n. I think that I got this. The bracket should be here. I'll correct that. Now remember, earlier we said, well, if we assume v1 and v2 of n are mutually uncorrelated, a good solution for f of n would just be delta of n minus d. If we assume that v1 and v2 of n are mutually uncorrelated, when we take the autocorrelation of this error, we're going to basically have all these v1, v2 terms cancel. And the optimal filter will just be a time delay. This produces then, if this was the case, this produces a filter E of n, which is just going to be v2 of n minus v1 of n minus d, and the expectation of E squared of n will just be equal to the powers of these noise signals. But there are some drawbacks to this approach. Why is this not a good assumption? Well, we talked about that earlier. If, in fact, V2 of n and V1 of n are different in their spectral characteristics, which is often the case, then when you difference these two, you, in fact, rather than canceling the noise, you'll actually make the noise larger, because if they're the slightest bit out of phase, when you difference them, it actually enhances the noise. This is a common problem with these kind of adaptive filters. So if you get the delay wrong or you get the spectral coloration wrong, the filter's actually going to do worse. And that's why we need a very solid approach like the LMS approach, where we know that we're going to constantly be minimizing error energy and making sure thereby that things won't be worse than when we started. So casting this as an adaptive filter allows us then to estimate our filter coefficients using the same techniques we've been using previously, which is the new estimate of the filter coefficients will be equal to the old estimate of the filter coefficients plus alpha, an adaptation speed, times the dot product of the error and the previous samples of the signal. And the error signal, then, as we said, is the difference between x2 minus yn, and that's just going to be x2 minus the filter convolved with this signal x1 of n. But that signal consists of two things, s, the signal of interest, s of n, and the noise. So what we really are going to have here is v2 of n minus a filtered version of v1 of n, filtered and delayed version of v1 of n, and that's what we'd like, because then we can account for time delay and called spectral coloration. Now, the neat thing about doing this as an adaptive filter is that you don't have to explicitly estimate the time delay. All you're really going to be doing is updating the coefficients of this filter. Now, when we look at the impulse response of that filter, we would hope to see a peak in that filter at the time delay. But you don't really explicitly worry about the time delay, because the filter is going to take into account of that by simply, as you update that filter, the coefficients of that filter around the time delay are going to get large and the other coefficients will be small. And we'll show an example of that later. But that's another benefit of these adaptive filters is you don't really care what the time delay is. You just turn the filter on and let it learn that automatically. Now, we can also take a view of this in the frequency domain. You may recall our two-sided Wiener solution for the LMS filter. The filter F is given by the cross-correlation of X1 and X2 divided by the autocorrelation of X1, where, again, X1 is S of n plus V1 of n, X2 is S of n minus D plus V2 of n. In the noise-free case, if we assume that V1 and V2 are zero, the ideal filter, as we said, just turns out to be a time delay, delta of n minus d. And we know that the frequency response, we know that time delay is equivalent to phase delay. So the frequency response of this filter is just e to the minus j omega d. This is a function which has a magnitude of 1 and a phase of angle proportional to d. A more general solution for this in the non-zero noise case, but assuming V1 is equal to V2, is that the optimal filter is going to be the cross-correlation of S over the cross-correlation of S plus over the autocorrelation of S plus the autocorrelation of V. And again, we discussed, well, this is interesting from a theoretical point of view, but in practice we won't have access to this data, but we can use this result to look at some results for computer simulations. So in a textbook, they show four cases of running this adaptive filter on a signal with various types of coloration associated with it. So we have, in one case, just the signal. In the second case, we have that signal filtered by a bandpass filter. And then in these three cases, we vary the bandwidth of that bandpass filter. And then also, we assume a 10-sample delay on the signal. So what we have for these four plots on the left are essentially plots of the filter coefficients after you've done the LMS algorithm. And these are four signal conditions: a white noise input, a bandpass white noise input, and then the three types of colored noise. In this case, the sample frequency was set to 1,000 hertz. So you've got this LMS filter. You've got an FIR filter, which is 20 taps long, 20 coefficients, and you're iteratively estimating those 20 coefficients. And I think that I think 1 second of data was used here for these estimates. So after 1,000 samples, these are what the filter coefficients look like. So in the case of no noise, all the filter has to learn is the time delay. And you can see, in fact, that the filter set all the coefficients converge to zero except the coefficient at the time delay of the filter. So that's an ideal case. That's what we would expect. Now, in these other three cases, you can see that when the noise with the bandpass noise, you can see that the filter still peaks at the time delay, but you get various non-zero terms around the time delay depending on the bandwidth of the filter. So this is more what you will typically see in practice. You'll see the coefficients fairly close to zero, except in the neighborhood of the time delay, you'll see those coefficients have non-zero values, and they will hopefully peak at the actual time delay. These four plots on the right show examples of what happens to one particular coefficient, the coefficient at the 10th sample that represents the time delay, which should be the largest coefficient. It shows how that coefficient varies over time from 0 to 1,000 iterations. In other words, this is how the coefficient is adapting over time. And you can see that if your adaptation speed is set well, the coefficient fairly quickly is able to lock on to its final value. But you can also see that in the ideal case, it locks on to a value of 1, but as we impose the bandpass filtering, the converged value is much less than 1. And which is what we would expect. So that's just an example of how this adaptive filter operates under some simulated noise conditions. Now, you know, I always like to caution students that these experiments where you use signal plus artificial noise, like Gaussian white noise that you add digitally, you always get these nice results. In practice, in the real world, problems are much more complicated, and the convergence, getting these things to converge, is a little more challenging because the signal is correlated with the noise. So when you work in these areas, it's very important to go beyond just signal plus digitally added noise. And hopefully as you do your research, you'll think about that, because these kinds of algorithms almost always work very nicely when you take signals collected under clean conditions and you try to mix digital noise with them to simulate the noise conditions. Yeah.
The right side of the figure, what is the y-axis?
This is the value, the magnitude of the coefficient. So with the no noise case, the filter should be h of n is equal to delta of n minus capital D, right? And the value at D should be 1 and all the other values should be 0. So you see that here, that for the no noise, for the pure white noise case, the signal learns essentially the delay, and the amplitude of that coefficient is equal to 1.
And 200 or 300 iteration or something like converge it to the estimation.
Right. It's going, because remember, we're running it as an adaptive filter. I'm going back to the slide number 5, where what that plot is plotting is essentially this as a function of time for only the 10th coefficient. And this alpha controls that exponential curve. Okay, now, I'm going back to the slide with plots. In this case, alpha is set very, you might say, conservatively, so the system is underdamped or overdamping. I think overdamped is the right term. So it converges very nicely. If you set the adaptation speed too fast, what's going to happen is the filter is going to oscillate and then eventually settle down. And that's, in a no-noise case, that's dangerous, because the coefficient of the filter could become greater than 1 and become somewhat unstable. But in the real cases, you would probably see more of an oscillatory behavior And the convert, the adaptation speed alpha controls that. And we talked about last time, or two times ago, that the alpha is usually related to the power of the noise and some other considerations, because you don't, as your estimate gets better and better, you want to slow that adaptation speed so that you don't overshoot the true solution. And that's particularly, I'll talk a little bit about that at the end if we get to the echo cancellation example. Okay, but getting the right adaptation speed so you get this nice convergence is a problem that has to be carefully studied for most applications. And usually the adaptation speed has to be dynamic. It can't just be a constant, or you don't get this kind of convergence. Okay, so let me now spend a few minutes talking about an alternate approach called adaptive differential, a different class of algorithms called adaptive differential pulse code modulation. We've talked about time delay estimation, and we now want to talk about how we can integrate the concepts of linear prediction and adaptive filtering to actually reduce the number of bits required to transmit an audio signal. Adaptive differential pulse code modulation was developed in the 1960s, and it was one of the first compression techniques that was applied to not just audio signals. It was originally developed for audio, but it was fairly quickly applied to video signals as well, because it's a good general compression technique, and at the core of this algorithm is an LMS filter. So we can use our LMS filter as a linear predictor to reduce the dynamic range of and compress an audio signal. So in the upper right here, I show a block diagram of what is essentially a generic differential encoder. The way this works is we have an input signal of interest, S of n. We're going to somehow produce an estimate of S of n using an adaptive filter. We're going to difference these two and then quantize the difference of these two signals, and then we're going to transmit the error signal and hopefully, if this all works properly, it will require less bits to quantize the error signal than it did to quantize the original signal. And then also, hopefully, if it works properly, and we'll talk about that a little bit, when you receive the error signal, we can reconstruct the original signal, or an approximation of the original signal. Now, for this to work, what must be true about the statistics of this error signal as compared to the statistics of S of n? So let's think about this in the context of an audio signal. S of n, speech signals transmitted over the telephone, have a bandwidth of 4,000 hertz. So we sample them at 8,000 hertz. In the original development of the speech signal, we used 16 bits per sample. So we have 8,000 hertz times 16 bits, which gives us 64,000 bits per second. No, that's not quite right. Right? 8 times 16 isn't 64. It's 128. Right? But we transmit speech at 64,000 bits per second. So how did we go from 128,000 bits per second to 64,000 bits per second? Some of you must have seen some of this in your DSP courses. So pulse code modulation doesn't just refer to a process we call linear quantization. but it actually goes one step further. And it looks at the speed signal and tries to adjust the quantizer so that the resolution of the quantizer matches the resolution of the human ear, or matches the way we perceive audio signals. And if you study that problem carefully enough, there's a very nice development which shows that the best way to do that quantizer is to arrange it in logarithmic steps, because we're not as sensitive to changes in large values of the signal as we are to changes in smaller values of the signal. So what we actually do with this quantizer is we go from 16 bits to 8 bits per sample by using a very intelligently designed quantizer. So we won't really talk about that in this course, but that's something you should have seen perhaps in your DSP class. Now, so we have this signal, which is when people talk about pulse code modulation of voice, they're talking about a signal which is transmitted at 64,000 bits per second. In the early days of telephony, bandwidth was very precious, very expensive. It's a very precious resource. So anything you could do to reduce the 64,000 bits per second to 32,000 bits per second was welcome, or 16,000 bits per second, or in the case of cell phones, 8,000 bits per second, or in the case of consumer toys, 2,000 bits per second. So if we're going to go from, let's say, 64,000 bits per second to 32,000 bits per second, what must be true about the signal going into this quantizer? If you compared S of N and this error signal E of N, if you compare these two signals, what's going to have to be true if you're going to get some compression out of this system?
Transmitted difference.
Well, we are transmitting a difference, but what must be true about the statistics of that difference? So if statistically the difference signal is the same as the original signal, you're not going to be able to achieve any quantization. You're going to need the same number of bits to describe the error signal as you will to describe the original signal. The error signal should reduce, right? The dynamic range of that error signal should be lower than the dynamic range of the speed of the audio signal, the original signal. That's the principle behind differential quantization. Remove those components of the signal that are predictable, and you can then quantize the remaining signal with fewer bits. Now, there's a couple problems with that. First of all, how are we going to reduce the dynamic range of the signal? Well, we said we're going to use an adaptive filter, and we're going to try to predict the current value of the signal from previous values of the signal using a prediction filter. And we've talked about linear prediction using LMS. But if we want to reconstruct this signal at the receiver, and we use this kind of a scenario, what is the information we're going to have to transmit to the receiver? The what? Go ahead.
Reduced. Those predictable components must be transmitted.
Okay, and where is that information encoded?
In the filter.
The filter coefficients, right? So, in addition to simply transmitting a quantized version of the error, we're going to have to transmit those filter coefficients, right? Well, when people first began thinking about this, they pretty quickly realized that if you transmit those filter coefficients, the amount of bits you're going to need for both of these is actually greater than what you would need to transmit the original signal. Because if you're, you know, originally they were looking at perhaps just a factor of 2 reduction in the number of bits here, but you would have to transmit those coefficients, in theory, you'd have to transmit them every sample or every few samples. And there might be some number of them, 10, 20, 30 of them. And those are floating point numbers, so you have to figure out how to quantize them. So that all didn't look too good. But if you think about this hard enough, what you can actually show is that you can't, as long as you run these filters sort of identically, and you start them from the same starting point, you can actually recover the filter coefficients from at the receiver without transmitting them. You can recover them essentially from the error signal. Because you're going to run in reverse the same adaptation algorithm that you ran here. So the reason these differential coders were popular is that you did not need to transmit the coefficients, the filter coefficients F. All you needed to do was transmit the error signal, and then you can reconstruct the result using an adaptive filter where you run the prediction of the filter coefficients on the output at the receiver. Now, the details of this are very interesting, really good work, profound stuff. But that, you know, that's covered more in a compression course, so we won't go into that kind of detail here. We'll focus more on how you use this filter to predict the signal, but I think it's interesting just to be aware of that problem, that the side information in these differential encoders can always kill you. Further, sometimes you actually have to synchronize these two, because this will get out of sync if you don't periodically synchronize it. So they actually embed what are called synchronization bits in the bit stream, and that's another really interesting piece of technology that was developed to do this. Now, when they were finished with this in the late 60s, they were very happy to be getting a factor of 2 reduction. So telephone calls went from being transmitted at 64,000 bits per second to being transmitted at 32,000 bits per second. And the hardware required to do this was actually, even back in the early 70s, a single chip, a fairly small chip, very low power chip. So the computational requirements were simple enough that it was there was a cost benefit to implementing this on all telephone channels, particularly long distance telephone calls, which in those days were very, very expensive. Overseas telephone calls, as many foreign students know, were very, very expensive in those days. And bandwidth was limited because there were only a few of these cables that could transmit international phone calls and all that. So this was a very popular technology. It's since been replaced with much more powerful technology in things like cell phones, where you get greater amounts of compression, but also greater amounts of distortion. But this technology allowed you to go from 64,000 bits per second to 32,000 bits per second with virtually no loss in audio quality. So, the way this works, we have the error signal, which is the difference of our original signal and our predicted value of the signal. We then quantize that error signal using a logarithmically spaced quantizer, but it'll have fewer bits associated with it. And the prediction filter has the form of the coefficients convolved with the error signal. And we invert this process at the receiver. We reconstruct the current signal based on the previous value of the current signal plus our quantized version of the error signal, which we receive over the channel. And the filter coefficients are updated using our standard update equation for the filter coefficients, which means we take the previous value of the filter coefficients plus alpha. In this case, we take alpha times the error signal, the quantized error signal, and we use the quantized error signal because both the receiver and the analyzer are going to have access to the quantized error signal. And that's one of the reasons we can reconstruct the coefficients at the receiver without actually having the coefficients of the filter, having to send those. And then there is a synchronization problem that has to be dealt with in practice. Now, why this work? Why does this work for signals like speech signals, let's say? Well, for audio signals, this filter is essentially very much like a linear prediction filter. It's going to be a fairly low order model of the speech spectrum. What aspects of the speech signal do we need to model to be able to predict current values of the speech signal from previous values of the speech signal? Well, if you think about speech, there's both a long-term spectral characteristic and a short-term spectral characteristic. The short-term spectral characteristic relates to the particular sounds that I'm speaking and the way I'm moving what are called my articulators. That short-term spectral characteristic changes over time because the sounds that I'm speaking change every, on a scale of about tens of milliseconds. That's one of the reasons why this adaptive filter is a nice solution, because it can actually adapt to the changing spectral structure of my voice over time. But it doesn't really care that it's a speech signal. It's just trying to model the short-term spectral variations over time. The same approach works for video signals, which have a completely different structure associated with them. But really, a video signal is just another signal that has a spectrum which is changing versus time. So this can be applied to almost any kind of signal. In fact, one of the concerns when this was first introduced was the extent to which it would distort modem signals and things like that that were transmitting digital data. And it turns out you can actually pass you might call analog modem signals through this system, and they will not be too heavily distorted. Because all this system is doing is predicting current values of the signal from the short-term spectral structure of the signal. And if the prediction is not working well, you can always increase the sample frequency so that you're sampling the signal at shorter and shorter time intervals, which means the signal changes less and less. So the higher your sample frequency, the smaller the amount the signal changes between samples, the smaller the dynamic range that you need for this quantizer. So there's actually an extreme version of this called delta modulation, where you take the speech signal and you sample it at a very high rate, typically 128 kilohertz, and then you encode this error signal using only one bit, either up or down. And delta mod was used in some of the early voicemail systems. And it was a very popular technique because it was very, very, very simple to implement in hardware. And it worked across a broad range of signals because all it really did was it increased the sample frequency to the point where the changes from sample to sample in the signal were very small. ADPCM, on the other hand, tended to work at the sample frequency of the original signal because you wanted this to be a one-for-one replacement with existing systems. So ADPCM worked on 8 kilohertz sampled speech and reduced the bit rate from 64 kilobits to 32 kilobits. Delta mod typically would go up to a sample frequency of maybe 128 kilohertz, but you could actually reduce the bandwidth below 32 kilohertz down to about 16 kilobits. Then algorithms came along which got much more intelligent about this filter and about how to encode the error signal. And the major algorithm there was something called code-excited linear prediction. And that algorithm allowed us to get down to 8 kilobits and 4 kilobits. Okay, so we have a few minutes left. So let me just say a couple words about a third application which blends the two things we talked about, time delay estimation and adaptive filtering, LMS adaptive filtering, to remove echo. In the olden days, when telephone systems were analog, and some of you from foreign countries may know this problem very well because echo was a real problem with a lot of the old telephony equipment implemented in foreign countries, you know, back in, let's say, the 70s. When you have an analog phone line, if you remember what an analog phone looks like, those big old phones, you know, with the big handsets and the big ringer bells and all that, in this kind of a scenario, you essentially, I don't know how much you've ever philosophized or reflected on the telephone. It's a pretty amazing invention. But two wires come into your house, right? And those two wires actually contain signals flowing in two directions. You have your voice going out and the other party's voice coming in. Right? Well, how do we do this with only two wires? This actually was a very interesting, that's one of the key aspects of the telephone that people often overlook. Well, one of the ways that that was done was by introducing what's called a hybrid at each end of the phone line. And the job of this hybrid was to detect which directions the signal was flowing in and separating it. So you actually have a transformer-ish looking thing in your old analog phone. These were at both ends of the network. Now the problem with that was that very often the signal from the far end talker would go through this hybrid and some of that signal would actually go back out with the originating signal from what's called the near end. So if this is you talking wherever you live, and this is me talking from my office, the far end talker, if I'm the far end talker, when I talk, my signal goes out over the network, hits your telephone, and bounces off that coil and comes back along with your voice. Now, we've all experienced this as echo. When you sometimes you get these bad connections, and when you talk, you hear your voice a few milliseconds later. One of the interesting things about this is if that echo happens over a period of about 1 to 2 milliseconds or 5 milliseconds, you don't actually notice it. In fact, we're so used to that echo that when I remove that echo, when I cannot hear myself talking, I somehow start to talk a little differently, louder. Right, so you're all familiar now with the modern day equivalent of this is you're talking to somebody listening with their iPod and they're shouting at you. And you tell them, hey, stop yelling. And okay. They take out their iPod, their phone, right? Because we're so used to hearing the volume of our voice to control our voice. So if this echo happens in a very short amount of time, it's okay. It's actually natural. But when that echo happens, when that delay is more than about a quarter of a second, 250 milliseconds, it's a very, very interesting phenomenon because then all of a sudden it starts to prevent you from talking. Because as you start to speak, you hear your voice far enough, delayed in time so much that it interrupts your ability to speak. And we actually used to demonstrate this when I teach the speech recognition class. We used to have a little demo where you could control the delay on the computer. And it was hilarious to listen to people talk, and then as you increase the delay, when you cross this threshold of about a quarter of a second, they literally could no longer speak because the delay is so large. I'm sure have experienced this, even on cell phones and things. So the question was, how to deal with this in the 1960s, because another thing happened that changed the game. When phone calls were transmitted only over copper wires, the round-trip delays were still small enough that this wasn't much of a problem, except maybe on extreme international calls. But in the 1960s, there was another major change to the phone network. What was that? I know it's ancient history for you guys, but... See, one of the interesting things about this is I find is how advances in technology often create new problems. So there was a fundamental change in the telephone network in the 1960s.
Packet switch.
No. Much more fundamental than that. It actually really took place in the 70s, but the beginnings of it was in the 1960s. The Russians had this crazy idea in the late 50s of doing what? What was the big thing that happened in the late 1950s that changed the world forever?
First, standardized.
They decided they were going to put somebody up in space, right? And shortly after that, the phone companies realized, hey, we could put satellites up in space and send telephone calls over satellites much more effectively than we could run cables underneath the ground. You know, they were literally, in those days, were running cables under the Atlantic Ocean to reach Europe and other places. And they were having to run electrical cables. I mean, imagine this back then. You know, you're running electricity under thousands of miles of seawater, salt water, ocean water, rather. That was a really nasty problem. So why not just bounce them off the satellites? Well, there's one little problem with that, which relates to this. What happens when you send a signal over satellite? And if you come to my house, I'll show you this for data. I have an internet connection over satellite. And it's great when you're downloading things, but it's terrible when I type. Why? When you send signals over satellites...
Latency is too
great. What?
Latency
is too great. There's like a quarter of a second latency between the ground and the satellite and like a half second round trip. So once they started to put satellites up, all of a sudden they realized echo was a really, really bad problem. Something that could not be simply kind of tolerated. And that gave rise to the use of these digital echo cancelers. And the algorithm for this is very, very much like, it is an adaptive filter. And, you know, a little bit of a variation, but it's essentially an adaptive filter where, as we've discussed, the adaptation constant is varied in proportion to the power of the signal. And we won't discuss this today in great detail, but the echo cancelers became very, very critical to the analog telephone network. Now, as things have moved digital to digital, they are no longer as important because now we don't have as many of these hybrids. But interestingly enough, we still have these devices that your phone line hasn't changed in many cases. It's just now they're sending digital signals over those phone lines, DSL and things like that. But echo cancellation is really a problem anywhere where you have these kinds of analog transmissions. So the natural thing to do was to use a time delay estimation, LMS-based time delay estimation, to try to estimate the delay in the signal when it's being reflected off this hybrid, and then to put echo cancelers at each end so that when I receive your speech, the echo canceler removes the remnants of my speech that are embedded in that signal. And I no longer hear myself echoing. So they began deploying echo cancelers throughout the telephone network, and this problem was significantly mitigated. And in the early 70s, this was done with a fairly simple chip that was cost only a few dollars in those days. And this chip was actually estimating filters that had about 160 coefficients associated with them. So it was doing a fair amount of computation in real time back in the days when we didn't have very powerful processors. Over time, as I said, with digital transmission, these problems are going away. But digital transmission, like voice over IP, has a whole bunch of other problems associated with it, which are really interesting problems, like the fact that you send these packets out from a signal, the packets actually get dispersed all over the network. They go many different ways to the remote end, and then you have to sit at the remote end and collect all these packets. And sometimes, guess what, they get them out of order and the phone call sounds really strange. So you can think of that as sort of the modern day echo cancellation problem. But this was a problem that drove a lot of the adaptive filtering and adaptive signal processing research in the 70s and early 80s. Okay. So we'll pick this up on Thursday when we're going to start Chapter 6. So in Chapter 6, we're going to talk about different computational forms for doing the adaptation part of the filter. Things like leaky gradient descent and lattice filter structures and such. And show you that there are different ways other than just a simple first order adaptation. And then eventually, towards the second half of the course, we're going to show you statistical, very powerful statistical methods to do this adaptation. Okay.